The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of its hosts, guests, or callers, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of WTBR-FM, its management, other producers, or sponsors.
Good morning. Welcome to Morning Drive here on 89.7 WTBR-FM, Pittsfield Community Radio. Also listening to us on 88.1 WSBR in Lee Lennox, Stockbridge. Watching us on the PCTV Select app and on 1301 Access Pittsfield on your cable dial. Sean Sayre here with you this morning. It is Thursday, April 9th, and we are live and local here in the WTBR studio on Federico Drive. Kind of a chilly morning out there, a little frost on your windshield you're going to find when you're getting out there. It's about 20, it says 24 here. It seems like maybe a little warmer than that, maybe 28, but not much. It is going to warm up, I hear, into the 50s today and maybe even a little warmer tomorrow with some rain later tomorrow night. I've got a great show here for you this morning. We have folks from Berkshire Environmental Action Team on, Brittany Ebling and Melanie McCarthy, going to be joining me to talk about the organization, some transitions that have happened at the organization recently, and some of the programs and efforts that they've got going on in the upcoming future. So we'll talk to them about all of that and more. First, let's get to our weather forecast from the National Weather Service and find out what exactly is going to be happening later today. Here we go. Berkshire
Weather. WTBR radar weather for the Pittsfield area. Rest of tonight, clear, cold. Near steady temperature in the upper 20s. South wind 5 to 10 miles per hour. Thursday, sunny. Not as cool with highs in the upper 50s. South wind 10 to 15 miles per hour. Gusts up to 30 miles per hour in the afternoon. Thursday night, mostly clear. Lows in the mid 30s. South wind 10 to 15 miles per hour. Gusts up to 30 miles per hour in the evening. Weather forecasts for WTBR-FM are provided by the National Weather Service.
All right, there you have it, our weather forecast. And, you know, we're starting to feel like spring now. We're getting a little further and further from that snow we had earlier in the week. Yeah, that was kind of a surprise to see about a half an inch to an inch of snow out there. But it is April and things happen. I've seen snow in May. I don't want to predict that for this year, but it certainly could happen. Good morning again. Morning Drive here, welcoming you and welcoming the folks from BEAT, Berkshire Environmental Action Team. Brittany Ebling, I'll get that right this time, and Melanie McCarthy, thank you so much for being here this morning. Good to see both of you so early in the morning.
Oh, yes. Thank you for having us. Post-coffee.
Yeah. Always. Morning. Always got to have the coffee.
Yes.
Yes. So I'll introduce both of you. So, Brittany, you are the new executive director.
Yes.
At BEAT, at Berkshire Environmental Action Team. Melanie, you are deputy director.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is a transition, as listeners here would certainly know, that we've interviewed Jane Wynn many, many times over the years.
Yeah.
And she retired last year. So that's kind of a big deal for an organization. So congratulations, first of all, both of you on the new positions.
Thank you.
Tell us what that transition is like and has been like when you have a long-time founding executive director, someone who's been involved very, very strongly in the organization, really, from its founding, and then making that transition and moving on. It's a theme that we're hearing more and more this year from a lot of organizations.
Absolutely, yeah. And we've been saying that no one can really step into Jane's shoes or replace her, but we are following in her footsteps. After 22 years of running the organization, Jane is such an incredible community advocate and activist. Started thinking about her retirement a few years before it took place and really wanted to have a very slow, intentional, deliberate onboarding of her replacement or replacements in this case. And so she began thinking about succession planning, and I started with BEAT about 3 years ago as deputy director in the role that Melanie holds now. And Jane and I started working together, and I was learning the ropes and building relationships with community partners and Beat supporters and various state institutions we partner with to do our work in the Berkshires and across the state. And then when it came time for Jane to think about having more time to go on vacation and really retire, we were so glad to celebrate her last year with a big retirement party and mm-hmm. to now count her as our number one volunteer and board member emeritus, and to just have had the experience of being so thoroughly supported by someone who was a founder, Beat is in Jane's blood, but also profoundly just wanted to see it pass on to the next generation of environmental stewards. I think that takes an incredible amount of egoless drive mm-hmm. and humility. And I think for many people, it's hard to envision an organization without a founder because their identity is so wrapped up in what it is. But in the case of Jane and Beat, she was really glad to let it fly free and have mm-hmm. its own wings. So we benefit from that very much in being able to envision its next steps.
Well, those sound like qualities that are in short supply.
Right? And, yes.
It also sounds like the process is almost like the dream process, right? Of knowing when there's going to be mm-hmm. a transition, knowing when someone is going to retire,
yeah.
and then having the foresight to plan that out years in advance and to know that you will be handing off the reins to someone and that the organization will be in good hands and that mm-hmm. they'll have all the tools that they need to make that work, right? I mean, that's not every organization gets that either.
Exactly. And I think Jane's phone has been ringing off the hook because people want to know how she did that. And it's hard to tell people that, well, the first step is that you have to sort of consider your own feeling of letting go and being okay with the mm-hmm. fact that some things will be different. And you might be bringing your own passion for specific dimensions of the work that might differ from what the next person will do. And if you can be okay with that, there's so much potential that can arise from it. But if not, there's a lot of initial interpersonal or inner work to do before it can really begin. But yeah, I agree. It's sort of the best case scenario, especially for a group that is so focused on relationship building on the grassroots level in the Berkshires, because baked into that is a requirement for just meeting people and developing community relationships.
It is really all about the people, isn't it? And you mentioned sort of the identity of a founder, someone who has been in the position a long time. I would imagine that's probably the key is that introspection, right? Mm-hmm. And someone has to say, okay, I'm moving on to this next chapter of my life,
mm-hmm.
And I'm going to make sure that this thing I love that I've done for so long is good, and yet I'm going to prepare myself for the fact that I will not have that identity going mm-hmm. forward. I'll have a different identity. It'll always be part of me, right? But I'll be different. That's, I think, the hardest thing for people to grapple with.
Absolutely. Jane told me that at one point she read that it's a really good exercise for founders who are looking ahead to retirement, probably for anyone looking ahead to retirement, to think about what are the things I'm excited to do in my life beyond this, and mm-hmm. what can I really anticipate and grab onto that is not attached to the way that the day-to-day might look right now, doing all the accounting and administration and nonprofit management.
Mm-hmm.
And likewise, for us to engage in the thought experiment of imagining what will the future of this organization look like that went from being an all-volunteer, very scrappy group out of Jane's spare bedroom in her home to having this beautiful center on the banks of the Southwest branch of the Housatonic in the community that we love. So I think that it's also an opportunity for us to think about what it has been, what it is now, and mm-hmm. what we dream that it will become as a real staple institution in the Berkshires.
And Brittany, of course, you started as a deputy director in this process and rose to become the new executive director. And Melanie, where were you before you're now the deputy director? What types of things had you done with Beat before stepping into this role?
I was an unofficial volunteer for Beat with salamanders on the vernal pond that I live on.
Oh,
but
wow.
I hadn't worked with Beat before, just was familiar with them and read a lot of their research. I was the director of an art gallery and community center in Housatonic. It is Center for Peace Through Culture.
Okay.
And one exhibit we did was a water rights exhibit, and that was involved a lot of Beats research as well. And one of our artists actually did a big oil painting from Beats research. And that organization was very much responding to community needs, and I was really interested in using it as a community center in Housatonic. And I hope to bring that kind of response and action to Beat from listening to what people need and just, you know, being that person in the community.
So it always been kind of a passion of yours. Also, it sounds like it was always a if you were dealing with the vernal pools in your own neighborhood and your own property, right?
Yeah, I love being outside, and I love, you know, just taking in the land and seeing how, you know, it moves on its own and how to respond to it. And I do a lot of gardening and yeah.
And Melanie is also a talented human rights practitioner in a previous life as well, and has a really rich background. Not to speak for you, but I think Melanie's very humble too. Has a legal background, has worked all over the world doing human rights work. So,
well, and that kind of goes hand in hand, doesn't it, with environmental action in a lot of ways.
It does.
Human rights and environmental rights are tied together.
Yeah, absolutely, because it's, you know, who is affected the most and who is affected first is, you know, certain minorities, certain groups of people, you know, on purpose, usually, you know, it's a known fact, and how do we prevent that from happening more going forward?
It's a fight that never ends in a lot of ways, right?
Yeah.
And sometimes the pendulum swings one way and then it swings back the other way. And it feels like sometimes now we're on the other side of that pendulum swinging right now.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's true whether you're speaking in an international context or in Pittsfield, where formerly redlined neighborhoods still bear the brunt of industrial sources of pollution. And we have in Pittsfield a 12.5-year life expectancy difference between neighborhoods that are directly adjacent, which is
to this day.
To this day.
And it's a legacy of what happened years and decades before.
A legacy and in many respects also an ongoing story about environmental injustice. We were over the past 3 years conducting air quality monitoring using stationary monitors and mobile monitoring equipment throughout Pittsfield. And there is a peaking power plant adjacent to neighborhoods that are very affected in Pittsfield by ongoing sources of air pollution that we would like to see gone. And it is materially real and active every day that community members who live next to Pittsfield Generating are exposed to this fine particulate matter and a variety of pollutants that relate to industrial practices we maintain in not just the Berkshires, but also communities the country over. And these are related to governance and political choices that also can be changed and that communities have power to address through thinking about environmental justice in new light.
Yeah, it seems like a fairly recent sort of, you know, getting into the zeitgeist of knowing that the legacy of our Industrial Revolution, you know, going way back to the middle 1800s, affected people in different ways. Like, oh, I'm sure at the time, all we thought about was, did we have a factory that was working that, you know, provided jobs for people to go to work to, you know, provide for their families and things. And then the other stuff was secondary. And I'm always remembering the idea that the East End of London, for example, was always the poorest area and the sickest area. And nobody really ever connected that with the idea that the factory smoke always blew in, right in that direction. And so that always kind of stuck in my head of how these things work. So what you just mentioned about the peaker plant in Pittsfield, which was really only a recent addition, you know, in terms of the long history of the area. It was only built in the in 1990 or 1991, but it's kind of near. And I've spoken to Rose Wessel about this many times on the show. It's near the end of its useful life.
Yeah.
And so what's next for something like that, right? And that's the kind of thing that Beat is constantly working on advocating for, right?
Absolutely. And we're really glad that now the state, as this other layer of governance over all kinds of energy siting and projects is thinking about cumulative impact and requiring cumulative impact assessments as part of evaluating proposed energy infrastructure projects, meaning that we can no longer think about these kinds of energy infrastructure developments as if they are being proposed and exist in a vacuum. Mm-hmm. If a peaking power plant is proposed by a developer in a community where there are already polluting facilities adjacent to neighborhoods and residential areas, we need to think about these potential pollutants as interacting and compounding on one another. So we're mm-hmm. glad to see that that is a framework through which the state is thinking about the impact on communities of energy facilities specifically.
Mm. Are they taking a more holistic approach to that now of looking at everything and not just the one, focusing on the one? It's very easy to say, you know, we hear this all the time, you know, work on jobs. We need jobs in the area. And that's a very big priority for every administration that comes in. Are they also looking through the lens of that and saying, okay, but they also need to preserve the environment, they need to preserve the climate, the things that we, you know, can't get back if we ruin them, rivers and the lakes and every living thing underneath, right? Is that something that's creeping more and more into the way that policy is made now?
Yes and no. It's a really big question.
Yeah, of course.
We're encouraged by efforts within state agencies like the Environmental Justice Office of the state that is asking not only its own agency, but also others to take into account environmental justice impacts of a range of private sector and state-driven activities. But on the other side, you have Governor Healey proposing an all-of-the-above approach to energy mm-hmm. affordability, which mm-hmm. brings in really critical questions about fossil fuel pipeline proposals being resurrected and risks to community health and the well-being of wildlife and the environment. So I don't want to say I'm optimistic, but I think that there is a push and pull between these forces at all times, and the role of community organizers, groups like BEAT and advocates across the state is always to push in the right direction and support those efforts.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with Brittany Ebeling and Melanie McCarthy from BEAT, Berkshire Environmental Action Team, here this morning on Morning Drive on 89.7 WTBR FM, Pittsfield Community Radio, if you're just joining us. And we're talking about sort of the top level stuff right now of what BEAT does. If you're not familiar with the organization, you might see a few things in the air quality. Monitoring was a big program that was, you said, about 3 years.
Yes.
Worth was that funded by a grant, and that's why the program came to an end?
We will still continue working to make sure that our stationary air quality monitoring data is available, as those will continue being available. We also work with school groups and community groups as we own the handheld air quality sensors that were purchased through this EPA grant.
Okay.
And as events arise that touch on issues related to air quality, we're likely to see more wildfire events and impacts from exposure from human-made sort of one-off or annual events. Like one of the largest peak moments we noticed in air quality pollutants was during 4th of July fireworks celebrations. So we're likely to continue taking what we learned throughout the duration of this research and apply it to opportunities to make change in the local community. And we're grateful that Berkshire Regional Planning Commission will be picking up many of the threads of this work and looking at air quality data regionally across the entirety of the Berkshires.
What were some of the upshots of the project for monitoring air quality? What did you learn? What were the things that you can take away and know once we've measured the air quality in various parts of the city? Because it was multiple different monitors that were set up in different places, right? So you could sort of read what was going on in different places. And then those most of those are gone, but some stationary ones are still existing?
Yes, the routes that were being actively walked by a team of mobile monitoring part-time staff have concluded, but the stationary monitors and the data that they are collecting at 10 sites throughout Pittsfield are still available on Breathe Easy, an extension of BEAT that was beginning to catalog this data about air quality. I would encourage anyone who's interested to read the report that was just published about this three-year project that our colleagues Andrew and Drake just produced. It's really wonderful information that combines observations from not only the particulate matter and VOCs and other air quality data observed over these 3 years, but also from surveys on public health concerns, interviews with subject matter experts on the impacts on respiratory illness and potential inferences we can draw about environmental pollutants, interviews with community members, and community listening sessions like one we held about Pittsfield generating at Allendale Elementary School. But in broad strokes, we can say that air quality in Pittsfield is pretty good most of the time. This is a great finding. It was not necessarily the case everywhere at the time of the initiation of this grant, which was really driven by wanting to see the trash incinerating facility that was blowing purple smoke into the air in Pittsfield addressed, which it was.
Yeah. So, anyone who went to Berkshire Crossing and got out of their car in the parking lot there while that incinerator was running, that, you know, you had days where the wind was coming your way. And you'd say, oh, my God, how do they even allow this to happen? And I'm thinking to myself, well, that's on a day when the wind is blowing this way. What about other days where it's usually blowing the other way into neighborhoods, people's homes, and other things like that? So that was a major change, right?
Absolutely.
To take a 40-plus-year-old trash incinerator
Absolutely.
Offline.
Yes, and that's huge, especially at a time when the states and communities other than the Berkshires is entertaining proposals about biomass facilities, and we should really be moving away from this kind of polluting industry when we know that there are clean energy alternatives. And
How does a biomass facility differ from an incinerator? What are the kind of things that are different about those?
Well, it is a matter of what is being burned. So
they're both burning something.
Yes. Okay. And our stance as an organization is, let's stop burning things. Let's use the cheap and accessible sources of power and improvements to our grid technology that can bring avenues for affordability without burdening communities with additional pollution. We have many of the solutions at hand, and some of them are solutions that don't require major infrastructure upgrades. It's also a question of governance at the same time.
But there are some times when investment is necessary, and we go back to the peaker plant, for example. And I know that Rose Wessel has talked to me about the best reuse for a plant like that might be a battery storage facility, where basically instead of waiting for the peak demand to come on the grid, where you need to deliver a whole bunch more electricity at any one moment, now you've got some storage in a battery on that same property that can basically deliver the same thing. But that takes a level of investment somewhere from a company or from a government agency, something to make that happen, right?
Exactly. And it makes financial sense in the case of a plant that is already decommissioning. In West Springfield, BEAT has been working with Cogentrix, a company that owned two peaking power plants in the Berkshires that have since decommissioned, thanks to some prodding. And we're really glad that this plant in West Springfield, that was one of the most polluting peaking power plants in the state, has decommissioned. Springfield was historically considered the asthma capital of the United States. So it's no small thing to take away one of the major polluters. And they are in the process of introducing battery energy storage systems at this facility, which will mean that the town of West Springfield continues to see tax revenue as opposed to just a brownfield that is left. It's also a really good opportunity when you have a site like a former peaking power plant because you have access to interconnection infrastructure on site and you're reutilizing a brownfield as opposed to cutting down a forest to pass transmission infrastructure to be able to interconnect to the grid.
Well, as we've seen in Pittsfield here, too, nobody likes to see a brownfield.
Exactly.
A lot of different reasons, right? Because that always, you know, immediately says, okay, what could be happening here? No one's paying taxes on this, right? So that's bad for the economy, bad for the local budgets, for everything. And then also it kind of looks like blight in a lot of ways. It looks like something should be happening here. We should have some development. We should have something that we can be proud of. And yet we've just got, you know, a chain link fence and some old foundations or something like that. That is what I think of. And of course, whatever's underground.
Yeah.
Those are all the things I think that we think of when we hear brownfields and we say, well, how do I get ourselves out of that? And move on to the next phase.
Right. And we were really grateful to Pittsfield City Council, who, recognizing that fact, recently sent a letter in support of decommissioning Pittsfield Generating as a highly polluting peaking power plant and seeing it transition to a clean energy alternative like battery storage for exactly the reason you described. Mm. They recently unanimously voted to send a letter to the Office of Energy Transformation requesting essentially just that. This new office of the state is convening working groups that join industry representatives from a variety of plants across the state with advocates and others who are exploring how to decarbonize the peak. So each of these plants, including Pittsfield Generating, plays a role in meeting our climate goals and trying to make that transition.
And what would be some incentives that these companies would have to make that transition? Because I'm sure there's a certain amount of, okay, we've got an investment in this property, in this building, in this, you know, machinery, whatever, and it's suiting our needs just fine. So why should we move on to the next thing unless there's something that sort of gets them off the dime, right? That says, maybe the resistance is too much, or maybe there's some money to be made by making that transition. I mean, what kinds of things can we offer, public policy or otherwise, to make these types of transitions happen?
Absolutely. So we're very lucky in Massachusetts that we have something called the Clean Peak Standard, which incentivizes and provides financial rationale for developers to bring batteries online as competitive with other types of energy infrastructure. This is not always the case, and it's also a question of just more than Massachusetts, but here in the Northeast, our grid is operated by the regional grid operator ISO New England, which is overseeing several states, and there are governance decisions that ISO New England could make that would further incentivize clean energy technologies and make them truly competitive with fossil fuel-based ones to bring more of these resources online.
And I would imagine, too, probably complicating things, and both of you could speak to that if you like, is what's going on at the federal level, right? Mm-hmm. Because obviously that influences the flow of money to be able to do these kinds of things that the states need to make that happen. And certainly in this particular administration, it looks like a lot of that is being sidelined. I think of the offshore wind projects that
exactly.
the money had been pulled for, right? Those were already well into development. They were getting built and then stopped, right? So how do you deal with that sort of uncertainty of knowing that right now, anyway, those kinds of projects may be, you know, not forthcoming?
So that's a great example, the offshore wind one. And although we're not, because of being a very Berkshires-linked organization working directly in offshore wind, BEAT is part of a statewide coalition called the Massachusetts Clean Peak Coalition. We work alongside groups Slingshot and Clean Energy Group, and recently met with a developer, a plant owner of the Canal Street Peaking Power Plant in Sandwich, Mass., who is part of this Office of Energy Transformation Working Group. They have been really interested in decarbonizing that plant and using the opportunity for offshore wind to combine clean energy offerings like battery storage with offshore wind and find financially smart, creative solutions to introducing new technology to the site.
Rely on any kind of federal funding to do?
It's been really affected by that.
Yeah.
And not only that, but there's also regulatory hurdles to be jumped through related to interconnection rights. Mm-hmm. And so the Massachusetts legislature has ultimately been helpful with the recent energy affordability bill having some provisions around surplus interconnection that will help projects like that move forward. But it's very hard without the support of some of the federal sources, especially on the financing side. But we appreciate the efforts of Massachusetts state-level institutions to try and continue to progress toward that. But we know that the solution is not to move backwards on our climate goals for 2030 and 2050. And we know that the solution is not to think about fossil fuel infrastructure.
And of course, renewable energy projects, even in the Berkshires, sometimes can be controversial. And I think of if you asked a lot of people in the Berkshires, do you want more wind turbines on your mountains? People might say, I don't know about that. You know, I kind of like the mountains the way they are. And why do we need more, you know, wind projects up there? If you ask people about solar, they might say, well, why are we, you know, cutting forests down or using arable farmland to put solar projects on? So I'm sure there's always a pushback when it comes to that as well.
Yeah, we've been doing a lot of community engagement work as it relates, not so much to wind. We're not seeing that come up in a big way, but certainly related to solar and increasingly battery energy storage systems, or BESS. We organized with the other members of the Clean Peak Coalition a webinar a few months ago that gave just a very informative, neutral overview of some of the considerations that communities face when entertaining proposals from developers on battery energy storage systems. And we were subsequently invited to give presentations and speak before a number of planning boards, community groups, and particularly in places where there have been many of these proposals. Mm-hmm. So we recognize that solar, battery systems, all kinds of renewable energy are foundational to ensuring our progress toward these climate goals. And we also think that there is a big difference between a well-sited project and a poorly sited one. We like to say that a great project, a wonderfully thoughtful clean energy project sited improperly is a problem. Yeah. It's not going to be a good project in the wrong place.
It's not a one-size-fits-all, for
exactly.
sure. So Brittany Ebeling and Melanie McCarthy are my guests here this morning from BEAT, Berkshire Environmental Action Team. We're at that top of the hour time, so we're going to take a little break and come back for part two of our conversation in just a moment. You're listening to Morning Drive here on 89.7 WTBR-FM, Pittsfield Community Radio. Stick around. We'll be right back after this.
Stay tuned for more Morning Drive here on WTBR-FM.
Pittsfield Community Radio, 89.7 WTBR-FM Pittsfield, 88.1 WSBR Lee.
Support for WTBR comes from Greylock Federal Credit Union, proud to support high school arts and sports programs to help our community thrive. Greylock Federal, with locations throughout the Berkshires and online at greylock.org.
And from UCP of Western Massachusetts, the Northern Berkshire Early Intervention Program is now accepting applications for an occupational therapist to support child development, empower families, and change futures. 2026 graduates welcome to apply. Apply today at ucpwma.org.
Hi, this is Sean Sayre, Executive Director of PCTV. When Taconic High School was demolished, we could have lost this radio station. Instead, PCTV stepped in, built a new studio and transmitter, and gave the station new life. And now it's time to pay that back. Support this station today. Go to WTBRFM.com and click the donate button. You won't be sorry. Pittsfield Community Radio thanks you for your support.
The motto of the Lions Club is, we serve. And for 99 years, the Pittsfield Lions Club has served our neighbors and aided causes both globally and right here in Berkshire County. Join the Pittsfield Lions Club as we grow our membership to explore new opportunities to serve our community while we prepare to celebrate our first century of service in the Berkshires. To learn more, please visit www.pittsfieldlionsclub.org or follow us on Facebook. Thank you.
Support for this public service announcement comes from Berkshire Community College and Park Square Productions.
Hey, this is Mike Pezzo. Remember those tunes your parents told you to turn down? Better yet, remember those tunes your grandparents told your parents to turn down? Well, on Mike's Amazing Music and Oldies show, you'll hear sometimes oldies, sometimes blues, sometimes local performers, and a lot of rock on Berkshire County's only rock station, 89.7 WTBR-FM, Pittsfield Community Radio, Thursdays at noon. Tune in and be entertained and educated.
Support for WTBR comes from Berkshire Community College. Free community college for any Massachusetts resident without a bachelor's degree at BCC. Find out more at berkshirecc.edu. And from Sandrini Awnings and Home Improvement, providing awnings and canopies in Western Massachusetts. Retractable awnings, retractable screen, gutter and gutter protection systems, commercial awnings and screen rooms, customized solutions available. Online at Sandrini.com.
Radio for people who used to love radio. Welcome back. WTBR.
And now back to the Morning Drive on WTBR-FM, Pittsfield Community Radio.
All right, there's the car horn. Welcome back to Morning Drive on 89.7 WTBR-FM, Pittsfield Community Radio. Also listening to us on 88.1 WSBR in Lee Lenox, Stockbridge, and watching us on the PCTV Select app. Your favorite device has that app for free, by the way. And channel 1301, Access Pittsfield on the cable dial. Sean Sayer here with you this morning. Thursday, April 9th. It's a kind of a crisp morning out there. The temperature is getting up there a little bit closer to freezing now. Nice and sunny morning, though. You're definitely going to get that sun visor down when you run in your car today. Brittany Ebling and Melanie McCarthy are guests here this morning from BEAT, Berkshire Environmental Action Team. We'll get right back to that conversation in just a moment. First, let's get to that weather forecast from the National Weather Service one more time and see what we've got in store for us today.
Berkshire Weather.
WTBR radar weather for the Pittsfield area. Rest of tonight, clear, cold. Near steady temperature in the upper 20s. South wind 5 to 10 miles per hour. Thursday, sunny. Not as cool with highs in the upper 50s. South wind 10 to 15 miles per hour. Gusts up to 30 miles per hour in the afternoon. Thursday night, mostly clear. Lows in the mid 30s. South wind 10 to 15 miles per hour. Gusts up to 30 miles per hour in the evening. Weather forecasts for WTBR-FM are provided by the National Weather Service.
Well, I'll take a sunny day in the 50s anytime. That's fine with me. A little bit of wind out there, but nothing to complain about. Nice day. All right. Welcome back to the show. And welcome back again, Brittany Ebling, the Executive Director of Berkshire Environmental Action Team, Melanie McCarthy, the Deputy Director. Thanks again for being here this morning and joining us and talking about BEAT and all the environmental concerns that BEAT represents. So one of the things I know that we wanted to talk about this morning was, I can't even believe I have to say this, PFAS sludge. Right?
Oh, yeah.
What is up with that? So, tell people, first of all, for people that aren't familiar, what PFAS is, first of all, and then why is it that putting it in having sludge put into fertilizer might be a bad idea?
So, these are big questions. PFAS refers to a class of many thousands of compounds that are referred to as forever chemicals. Mm. Because they really don't break down. I think the half-life of many PFAS is something like 10,000 years. So it's not going to biodegrade in your garden anytime in this lifetime.
And what were they created for, these chemicals?
They have been created by a number of industries. They're used widely in many products that most folks would find horrifying, including many products that we put on our bodies. You would find them in most every home in floss, in waterproof clothing, in shampoo, conditioner, soaps. It's really omnipresent and very hard to avoid. Cookware, certainly the Teflon pans have been in the news regularly.
And then firefighting foam, I think, was the other thing, right, that was widely used for.
Right. It's just everywhere. It's sort of something that is unavoidable. And so you have waste streams from industry that are producing PFAS, and they're in our homes. And so when you look at what is coming out of wastewater treatment plants that are creating these liquid waste streams and solid waste streams, you have dangerously high levels of PFAS. In 2025, the Department of Environmental Protection in the state of Massachusetts, also known as MassDEP, looked at samples of what the industry would refer to as biosolids or is otherwise called sludge. Mm. We would call sludge, mm-hmm. which is the solid waste coming out of wastewater treatment plants.
Okay.
And of every sample collected in every wastewater treatment plant in the state, and this is true everywhere, not just in Massachusetts, there are dangerously high levels of PFAS. It's much like lead. There is no safe level of exposure to PFAS, and the health conditions that play out for exposure, especially if you consume food that has been exposed to PFAS or otherwise have it in your body, can be absolutely detrimental for many years. And in states like Maine that have really taken the lead on addressing this issue, it came about because people were finding livestock that were dying and health issues cropping up in communities where it was later understood sludge had been extensively applied to soil. So
the sludge normally would be disposed of in, I assume, a landfill or something like that. But what you're saying is that some of the sludge found its way into basically back into the commercial market where it was sold or used for farms to be able to be used as fertilizer. So that seems like a real problem. If you the whole point is that there's no safe level of it, that you don't want this finding its way back into the food stream or into people's bodies.
Exactly.
That you certainly don't want it being used as fertilizer. And yet that's what's happening.
Yes, and it is a big money industry, the sludge industry, if we can say that as such. So I would love to say that it's normal to landfill it, and that is what we should be doing as a best case scenario. We should be getting stuff out of our landfills that doesn't belong there, like food waste and textiles, and the most ecologically sound thing to do with this extremely hazardous material is landfilling it. But unfortunately, we are putting it on soil. MassDEP last year commissioned a two-part study that looks at the supply chain of sludge and is sort of teeing up the agency ostensibly to introduce draft regulations. And we learned that the state of Massachusetts exports its sludge to, I believe, 15 other states. So this is not just something that is happening. It is being applied in Massachusetts, in the Berkshires, on farmland, but also it is impacting other states. At one point, all of New York City's sludge was going to a very small rural community in, I think, Texas. So these chains of environmental injustice across the country are very strong, and we have a responsibility to other communities to figure this out.
How does that process work when communities are looking for a place for whatever it is they have to go away? Right. I mean, that's ultimately what they're doing. If they've got trash that's, you know, and the city of Pittsfield just recently dealt with that by introducing toters so that that would encourage more recycling. And apparently it has. The numbers are coming in saying that people are throwing away less trash and putting more in recycling, which I guess was the whole goal. But at the end of the day, you still have stuff. Right. So we used to burn it. That's bad. We stopped doing that. I think everybody agrees. Not a great idea, but you still got the stuff. So it's got to go somewhere. It gets trucked into a landfill, some other state, somewhere else. Right. We don't have any more of those landfills, I don't believe, anyway, in Massachusetts. So how do communities manage that? How do they deal with it? How do those pathways end up getting created? Do you know?
So all wastewater treatment plants have contracts with companies like Casella's and others in the Berkshires. I think that is the primary company that is bidding in to offer alternatives about what can be done at what cost with a wastewater treatment plant sludge. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of that question that you posed is how we got linked in with some community activists in Williamstown who were entertaining a proposal being made by the wastewater treatment district that is overseen by two towns in North County. Maybe Melanie, you can share a little bit about what's going on in Williamstown with respect to that question.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, sludge, it will always exist, right? So the purpose of the bylaw we wrote for Williamstown, which was to ban the land application of sludge, was to prevent that aspect. So You know, it has to happen in phases, it seems. You know, we can't ban this from entirely existing, but we can ban it from being sold or being given to people at a very low cost or free. Mm-hmm. And just, you know, naming it as compost or fertilizer and not specifically saying what these things, what this contains, is a big problem. And there aren't, hopefully, you know, this bylaw will be repeated hopefully throughout other towns and counties without any negative impacts on the farmers or on people that have applied it, and like very low fees for if they do apply it again. The purpose is to just stop applying it. Mm. You know, we don't want people to be punished, but we want to end this process at this phase, and then work at other phases as we continue.
Well, it kind of has some echoes for me when I'm hearing about how it's being, you know, given at a very low cost or given away or something. And all I can think of is GE and the PCB soil from the, you know, 40s and 50s or whatever, where people were saying, oh, I need fill for my land because, you know, I need to slope my lawn. Oh, no problem here. The GE's giving all this away. And of course, it was full of PCBs, which eventually everybody had to, you know, abate that. And so I just it sounds like this is a very similar
I don't know if it's at that point of it being so low cost. I paid a lot of money for compost that eventually found out through my work at Beat was from a farm that gets their compost from the water treatment center. So there's also that, you know, fear of like, what have I done? What did I put on my vegetable garden? And we also want to try to provide resources for people that are affected and farmers that are affected.
We have been very supportive of the bill introduced by Senator Comerford in this legislative cycle that would do exactly as Melanie suggested, prevent the land application of sludge to soil. That's just like stop the bleed, the worst thing. But also, let's not inappropriately penalize the small farmer who has taken in good faith what the state and the federal government said for decades was safe. And let's provide blood testing so people know what is going on as a result of exposure to these contaminants with their health. Let's provide soil testing. And the state of Maine has laid out an exceptional pathway that other states can follow in addressing this on a large scale. They have done mapping using their public records. Right now, Beat is trying to reconstitute from public record searches what the extent of exposure in the Berkshires is. But why should a small nonprofit be doing that instead of the state? So we really look to the case of Maine, both in the sense of what the state has done and how civil society has supported farmers and supported communities trying to make sure that they are safe and not risking exposure once they realized how bad it really was.
Right. Well, certainly, just like the forever chemicals, this is an issue that's not going to go away anytime soon. It's certainly heating up. We hear reports about it in the media all the time, and different communities dealing with it on different levels. Certainly just over the border into not Steventown, but one of the towns up there in eastern New York.
Yes, I know
Hoosier
what you're referring
to. Falls in that area.
Yes, Mariah Blake just introduced a book called They Poison the World that really ruminates on the case of that community's response to PFAS exposure. And
And I think everybody in Pittsfield probably identifies with that, knowing what this community had gone through with GE and with PCB exposure. It's a different chemical. It's a different type of thing. But still, it feels a lot the same.
Absolutely.
Brittany Ebeling and Melanie McCarthy, my guests here this morning on Morning Drive from Beat, Berkshire Environmental Action Team. And we've got about 10 minutes left here of our interview. So let's move along to something about stocking fish. So this is something that people are used to in certain times of the year. The fishermen like to go out and catch some fish. And so the state will occasionally stock the river or a pond or something like that with some fish. The fishermen go out to catch the fish. And it sounds like kind of not a bad thing, except for the fact that the fish aren't necessarily native to those waterways, right? So what's going on with that?
Right. Right. So they're not necessarily native, and it's not necessarily occasional in the sense that this happens in it happens many thousands of times in a season across the state. So in certain water bodies, the state, specifically Mass Wildlife, which oversees the stocking program, is introducing these species up to five times a year in a specific location of various water bodies.
Is it usually rivers or is it lakes also?
All kinds of water bodies, rivers, lakes, streams, and
what are the most common fish that they're stocking it with?
Brown trout, rainbow trout, tiger trout, and then also some brook trout, which is our native species. But the introduction of this kind of brook trout can also pose problems when you have fish that are raised in an industrial factory setting that might have exposure to disease, that might perhaps breed with native brook trout that are of the wild population. In contexts out west, there is data that suggests that that can be highly problematic for the genetic diversity in the ecosystem of that native species. So it's not strictly that the non-native species are a problem, although they certainly pose the greatest harm to habitat, competition for resources with brook trout, and a whole host of other impacts.
So if the fish aren't native, the damage that they're doing is sometimes to the ecosystem of the river or the lake itself, or is it also that they're affecting, you know, other species or interbreeding with species? How does that work? And why is it bad? Because it's been happening for decades, right?
I would add, in addition, people shouldn't be eating these fish that are stocked because of where they're raised in the hatcheries, the food that they're being fed. Brittany especially did some research into that food and also high levels of antibiotics because people want big fish.
Sure.
Yeah. Do you want to speak to the food ingredients?
Yes, I would love to see anyone eat a pellet of screting fish pellet food.
That does really not gross. Sound appetizing
it's not,
to me.
Not very yummy.
No.
but yeah, that's absolutely a good point. And also reason to think twice before eating one of these stocked fish is that research done by Maine's Department of Environmental Protection, yet again leading the way on looking at PFAS, shows that within a week of being introduced into water bodies where there are dangerously high levels of PFAS, and the state in Massachusetts issues consumption advisories indicating that people should not eat fish or certain types of fish from various water bodies, but within a week, stocked fish take on PFAS levels in water bodies of that sort commensurate with those of wild populations. So it's not the case that there is this pure, unadulterated type of food that's introduced into the system. But of course, these things interact. And beyond that, there's also research in other neighboring areas of the Northeast that addresses the impact that brown trout have on competition with brook trout over habitat. Brown trout are pretty aggressive species of fish. There's also research from areas like New York State that suggests that the introduction of these non-native species can have deleterious effects on macroinvertebrates, and so there's also a need for research on the reverberating impacts on other species, not just fish populations. We would really like to see the state doing that kind of research.
What is a macroinvertebrate? Tell us what that is.
Yeah, think of like crayfish. You would not need a microscope to look at these critters.
Okay.
We'll be out doing some macroinvertebrate sampling in a few weeks in Housatonic, doing a project at Old Maids Park, and they tell a lot about the relative health of an ecosystem, and they're smaller than the fish surrounding them, but you can observe a lot about what's going on in the ecosystem, but they're not necessarily what Mass Wildlife is measuring to understand the impact of their stocking program.
So it's all about the food chain, right?
Exactly.
If these lakes and rivers were not being stocked with the fish, what would the native species be, and would there be enough like to go fishing? Is that why we stock them, because there just aren't enough fish in these rivers and waterways?
It's a good question. Why do we stock them? Yeah. It is very much for the purpose of recreation, and I think that some people would say that there would be declines because as communities, we have harmed these river ecosystems mm-hmm. and these lakes. In certain places, historically, mass wildlife eradicated entire fish populations in lakes so that they could introduce stocked populations wow. of fish. So there's sort wow. of layers of historical problems, mm-hmm. one on the other. But part of our ask to mass wildlife is to do this kind of research. What would happen if you stopped stocking? For example, in the Westfield River, there are three branches where stocking takes place. What if we stop stocking one of them and identify the impact not only on our native brook trout, but also on these other ecosystem indicators of well-being and health? Would the stream that stops being stocked rebound mm-hmm. and have increases in brook trout, or what would we notice? And mm-hmm. I think that kind of burden of proof should be imperative before we pour money into this as a state.
How long do you think it would take to find out how the impact would be? Would it be over the course of a couple of years? Would it be a longer term, 10 years, 20 years before we know what impact that would have?
It's a good question. I am not exactly sure, because I think that we're talking about analyzing all sorts of different ecosystem indicators. Mm. I think that we would probably start to observe certain impacts immediately. Yeah. For example, we know that in Pittsfield there are lakes where fish, brown trout, are moving upstream into areas where there are brook trout. So we might immediately notice that there's less movement of non-native species upstream or into areas that we want to protect, but it might take longer to identify some of the impacts on macroinvertebrates or the relationship with other invasive species or things of that sort. So I think it would probably be a mix.
We'll probably take time one way or the other. Brittany Ebeling and Melanie McCarthy here are my guests from BEAT, Berkshire Environmental Action Team. Just a couple minutes left of the show here this morning, and I want to make sure that we get a chance to talk about some of the upcoming summer events that you've got going on and your Green Drinks program. Talk about that in the time that we've got left.
Yeah. So very immediate and exciting is that this Saturday, we have an event called Making Way for Wildlife. We will be hosting two speakers, Dr. Patricia Kramer, who's writing the state's Wildlife Transportation Action Plan, and Ben Goldfarb, who is the author of Crossings and also wrote a wonderful book about beavers. We'll be doing stream table demonstration. This will take place at Berkshire Community College, and you can find more information on BEAT's website.
So that's this Saturday.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. 9:30 in the morning.
9:30, bright and early.
Morning, people.
We'll be serving coffee, yes. tea, muffins. Yeah, and it's free.
Yeah. Yes.
So free this Saturday at BCC at what time again?
9:30.
All right.
9:30.
For anyone interested.
We also have our monthly Green Drinks presentations ongoing. We'll have river cleanups this summer and a range of volunteer activities. Moth Night, we always look forward to that. Mm. Later this year, Biodiversity Day, which will be taking place in South County. And we encourage anyone who's interested in our range of upcoming events to stay posted on BEAT's biweekly e-newsletter, the BEAT News.
So give us that website where people can find all of that information and join if they want to, become a volunteer, right? I'm sure there are people listening right now saying, hey, I wouldn't mind getting involved with that. How do they do that?
You can find BEAT at www.thebeatnews.org, as in BEAT.
BEAT, not BEET.
Right.
Yeah. Got to do that for radio. Make sure that we get it out there. Well, Melanie and Brittany, I want to say thank you so much for being here this morning. It's been great talking with you all about what goes on with BEAT and some very important stuff there. And there's more that we can talk about. I'm sure we didn't even get to half of what BEAT does all the time. So let's have you back, and we'll talk more about it.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks for being here. And thanks, everybody, for joining us here in Morning Drive, as you always do. We appreciate you listening. And we will be back again tomorrow morning live from our WTBR studio. I'm Sean Sear. Have a great day, everybody. Take care.